This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman. My guest today is Alexander Rocklin, whose book, The Regulation of Religion and the Making of Hinduism in Colonial Trinidad, came out earlier this year with UNC Press. This book forces readers to take apart their assumptions about what religion is, and then builds up a fascinating account of the emergence of Hinduism in Trinidad into something recognizable as a religion. Set in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the book draws from a wide array of sources which hold some great stories. By bringing the history of Hinduism to bear on the history of Trinidad, the book makes you think about both in new ways. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It's really great to have you here, and I'm very excited to talk about this book with you. But before we start, I just wanted to hear you talk a little bit about how you came to the project in the first place.
Sure. So I had done coursework as an undergraduate in courses in religion in the Americas, as well as religions of South Asia. I studied abroad in Nepal and studied Hinduism and Buddhism there. And then after I graduated from college, I spent time, a year living in Mexico. And so when I came into my master's program, I was very interested in studying religions of South Asia. And also I was very interested in religions of the Americas. And I actually took a class with Dane Borges at the University of Chicago, the second year of my master's program, a course on religion in the Americas. And I kind of went to him, the final project for that course was a kind of bibliographical paper. And I didn't like any of the topics. So I came to him and I was like, you know, I'm going to be studying South Asia. I want to find something that's connected to that in the Americas. And so he let me kind of go off script and do a paper on Jose in Trinidad. And so I found this collection of primary sources about this massacre in 1884 in Trinidad, this massacre of participants in a Bahurim or Jose. That was collected by Kelvin Singh. It really kind of brought me in these, you know, the descriptions of these, you know, when people go in procession, they have these large models of the tombs of the Imams Hussein and Hassan, who are the grandsons of the Prophet Muhammad. And in particular, in looking at these primary sources, I was struck by the way in which people were having these arguments about whether or not Jose was religion or not. And so I began to, you know, continue to develop this paper when I was in my PhD program, continuing to think that I would go study in South Asia. And I did continued to do coursework and language work on studying Hindi and Urdu. And then finally, at some point, when I was kind of had to make a decision, I was like, well, can I just do this and study Trinidad? And so my advisors and folks in my department, you know, encouraged me to pursue whatever I found interesting. And in particular, I thought that the case of Trinidad was very compelling because I was very interested in the relationship between Hindus and Muslims in India, and also the role of the category of religion in the regulation of colonized populations, and the ways in which subalterns were able to kind of incorporate colonial categories and use them for their own purposes. And Trinidad was really a kind of microcosm because indentured laborers were so high, their lives were highly regulated. They were stuck on plantations. You really could see the ways in which there were these kind of profound effects of colonial regulation on people's lives. But I was also very interested in the ways in which people of Indian and African descent were kind of coming together in different kinds of ways to create lives for one another within the constraints of these colonial kind of the tyranny of colonial categories.
Yeah, and one of the really interesting things about your book is that it really requires a step back from a lot of assumptions about religion, in particular the idea that Hindu, or maybe you want to push this and say many religions, right, are this kind of a clearly distinguishable social entity, is I think how you put it, right? Mm-hmm. And so you want to kind of undo that. And the book actually talks about the process by which it becomes that thing. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I was wondering if there was a moment or a document or a source that kind of prompted that idea. It sounds a little bit like you found that already in the Jose documents, that mm-hmm. this idea of this kind of, it's much less solid than a religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so I think you're right. I would definitely say that, you know, the book itself is about Hinduism and kind of like the prehistory of Hinduism in Trinidad, like what happens before Hinduism becomes a thing, you know, quotation marks. But yeah, I would say that the kinds of arguments that I'm making are applicable to other, what we think of as religious traditions today. I'm broadly conceived interested in the processes of world religion making, how you know, different kinds of social formations begin to think about themselves in these the terms of religion, right? That religion itself is not a natural universal category, but has a particular history. I definitely, you know, in looking at the examples of Jose in Trinidad, and particularly the discussions around this massacre in 1884, you know, when the people who were participating in Jose in the mid 1880s, right, they weren't thinking of themselves as being like, you know, we're Muslims doing this Muslim ritual, right? Because Jose or Muharram, as it's referred to in India, you know, today people think of it as being a Muslim, and particularly Shi'i Muslim, commemoration of the martyrdom of the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. But you know, one particular document that's really struck me was there was this petition by this today we would say he's a Hindu headman, somebody who was, you know, had a leadership position on an estate. His name was Suku, and he wrote this petition to the government in 1884 after the government had said, you know, you're not allowed to take the tajas, these giant models of the tombs of the imams, on public roads. And so he writes this petition, or you know, him and a group of people write this petition. And from the names that are listed, you know, some of them we would say would be Hindu, or the government says some of them are Hindu and some of them Muslim. But none of the people who sign on, the petition itself doesn't talk about them being Hindu or Muslim. Doesn't talk about Muharram being a Muslim, you know, ritual. But they talk about it as their religion. And so that kind of struck me that, you know, that the government is saying you can't go out on public roads, that it's not really religious. Like, that it's not essentially religious to take these tajas out on the public roads. And then the indentured laborers are coming back and saying, no, it is religious. And then the government saying, no, it's not religious. And so it was this back and forth, this argument back and forth about whether or not it's religious or not. And particularly the way in which, at least in the petition, right, these Indo-Trinidadians are kind of adopting Protestant norms for what religion should be like. You know, they say we're very sober in our, when we go out, and we're, you know, this is part of our sincere belief. And so they're kind of picking up these ideals from Protestant Christianity and using them to shape how their rituals are being portrayed. As a kind of tactic in arguing with the government.
So now, since we're talking about Jose, I had a question I was holding for later, but now I want to ask it now. So how did writing this book make you rethink or think or invent or reflect on methodology? Because it seems like this is a kind of really intriguing book from the perspective of methodology. You're looking for something, but then also arguing that it's not actually there. And I was really intrigued by that challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in thinking about the examples, and I talk about this a little bit in the introduction, and also in the fourth chapter too, that there are, the difficulty is, I think a professor in undergrad described something similar to this. It's kind of like trying to write a computer program and run it at the same time. I mean, you're kind of watching people negotiating these categories and kind of looking at the kind of discourse clouds that get produced around these ritual communities, but also trying to study what people are doing at the same time. I mean, it's a really kind of challenging thing to see. On the one hand, as a historian and sort of thinking about what I'm doing as a historian, you know, kind of combing through these, through sitting and reading all of these newspapers and colonial documents. And then when you kind of find a fragment of something, try and kind of look through it and comb through it and try and find to the degree possible, the kind of voices and perspectives of indentured laborers, people of Indian descent, and people of African descent too, as far as they're participating in it as well. And try to kind of understand, you know, whether it's Muharram or Jose or firewalking, what are they doing in these ritual performances, and trying to get a sense of that. But at the same time, how are they talking about what they're doing? And this kind of self-reflexive move in for subalterns themselves was kind of what I was trying to pick out.
Right, and so for historians of the Caribbean, the category of obeya might be more familiar to people who are thinking about these kinds of issues. And you, I noticed that you talk about obeya in a couple of different places. And I want to just hear you talk about the relationship between obeya and the kinds of relationships with superhuman beings, as you call them, that you trace in the book. How did you think about those two together, and what kinds of things popped up in the documents?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the obeya is a problematic category that's, you know, historians and anthropologists have kind of been arguing over in, you know, Caribbean studies and in religious studies. And it's a really difficult category to define, in part because a lot of the evidence that we have, certainly historically, is stuff produced by colonizers themselves. And historically, within the Anglophone Caribbean, obeya has been illegal. It was illegal during the period of slavery, beginning with Tacky's War in Jamaica, and it was seen during the period of slavery as something that was something that would cause slave uprisings, and then after the end of slavery, it turns to something kind of like fraudulent practice. And Diana Payton has done really excellent work on this. There's when you have evidence of people doing what the colonizers are calling obeya, typically the person accused of doing obeya, they tend to deny that they're doing obeya, right? For the most part, even today, people would never say that they do obeya. And in fact, the really common thing for people to say is that they're doing science. And Brent Crossan is doing some really fascinating work on the idea of science in Trinidad and in the Caribbean. But at the same time, in trying to kind of negotiate, particularly, I was looking at examples of court cases in the early 20th century, where there were Indo-Trinidadians were being accused of practicing obeya, which most typically was defined as kind of black magic or African witchcraft. But at the same time, there was a kind of legal technical definition of it as the assumption of supernatural powers. And so in looking at these court cases, I was trying to read them kind of against themselves and think about how, you know, the cases themselves provide evidence of the ways in which Indo-Trinidadians were engaging in certain kinds of practices to maintain relationships with different sorts of superhuman beings, including gods, as well as spirits of the dead. But then when they end up in court being accused of obeah, they deny oftentimes that any of the stuff that's presented as evidence is actually accurate. And so it's kind of a problem of, you know, what is the degree to which we can take seriously the evidence that's presented in court by kind of police provocateurs and police officers. And I think we need to be kind of critical of that, but that's at the same time, it seems to be revealing of the ways in which really, you know, people certainly in the 19th and into the early 20th century were engaging in these really heterogeneous practices, and really their practices were cutting across reified religious and racial lines. So for instance, in the chapter on obeah, I look at the two cases at the very end, of one of Biru and one of Miraj, and Miraj is this guy who's accused of obeah. He says, when he's in court on he's on the stand, he says, "I am a Hindu priest. You know, I only work with Hindus, you know, and everything I do is kind of very orthodox." But the government is like, you know, the police officer is like, you know, you're working with Creoles and you're doing bush baths and you have crosses and, you know, you have rosaries and a statue of an angel. And he's like, you know, none of that stuff is mine. And I don't work with Creoles, and, you know, this Spanish mother and daughter came to me and tried to get me to do a bush bath, and they forced me to do it, and I didn't want to do it or whatever. So it's this again, the kind of contradictions in the kind of evidence that's being presented, which seems plausible, but at the same time, evidence that the people on trial are denying as being true. And they certainly have a very particular interest in denying that any of it's true, because this is the evidence that's, you know, will get them thrown in jail or you know, potentially with hard labor. So it's a problem. And I want to try and take seriously both the evidence presented in court, but also the kinds of arguments that people who are on trial are making themselves. And that itself is evidence of the ways in which Indo-Trinidadians are incorporating the category of religion and using it, as well as the category, you know, racial categories too, to try and present to try and protect their own interests.
Well, that's the really kind of paradoxical thing that emerges from the book, is that out of all of these interactions and all of these kinds of back and forth and the uses of categories, those kinds of interactions are actually productive of this category that we now call religion, right? And so it's really fascinating and really, really interesting to watch how you do that and how you pull things out. And eventually we do kind of come to this category that, you know, it's still contested, but people do agree that there is this thing called religion, including this great moment when you talk about these books from Chicago that were very instrumental in teaching people what it was that they were supposed to be ideally thinking about.
The Dorrance Scott and Company Laurent de Lawrence was a famous magician or wizard. I mean, he's a practitioner of magic. He was in Chicago, and so he circulated a lot of the books that he published were kind of plagiarized them. He stole them from previous magic books, grimoire. But they were so, yeah. I mean, so we have these, you know, Indo. Particularly the guy Miraj, who I mentioned, who was on trial for obeah, had, you know, says, you know, all of my books are correct religious books, and, you know, I'm a Hindu and I only do Hindu stuff. But he's found with de Lawrence's books in his possession. And de Lawrence himself was, you know, claimed to have been in communication with Hindu spirits and was practicing what he called Hindu magic. It's this, but at the same time, right, Miraj is seemingly experimenting with this kind of quote unquote obeah books, but also is very familiar with British colonial expectations for what religion ought to look like. And so is able to use that for his own purposes to sort of deny the accusation that he is kind of misattributing the agency of these books, for instance, or that he himself, you know, he's not claiming that he himself can can change, you know, can find people's lost loves or find lost objects or get people's jobs back. That he's just, he says he's just praying to God, right? He prays, and prayer is the only way to kind of get things done. And God is the only one who can really do these things.
The second half of the book, by the second half of the book, we've come to Hinduism as a kind of world religion, as you call it. And you talk about the way that it emerges out of these kind of interactions between missionaries and scholars and Indian elites. I was really fascinated by the discussion of organizations and institutions and the ways that they policed Hinduism in certain kinds of venues and sort of tried to shape it in a way that was both legible but also kind of follow according to some kind of definition of respectable or something like that.
I was very fascinated with the sort of like Hindu respectability politics that begin to emerge with the rise of Hindu identified Indo-Trinidadian middle class organizations. Overall, right, my argument in the book is that Hinduism, right, is not this kind of thing that Indians brought with them in the mid 19th century when they first arrive as indentured laborers, and it really only gets produced as a widespread collective identity and social formation beginning in the early 20th century, starting off in the 19 teens when the Arya Samaj missionaries, the Arya Samaj is a kind of Hindu reformist organization. They first begin to arrive in the 19 teens, and by the 1920s, the late 1920s and early 1930s, you have this kind of what is thought of as a kind of orthodox Hindu reaction. You have the kind of creation of a kind of quote unquote orthodox Hindu identity, and in the early 1930s is the first creation of these two Hindu organizations, the Sanatan Dharma Association and the Sanatan Dharma Board of Control, that are in competition with one another, and that are, as you mentioned, are very interested in kind of policing what becomes popular Hindu practice, and also are kind of policing one another. They're fighting with one another about, you know, who's really orthodox, who's really Hindu. And I was very, you know, interested in tracing like the contestations over who gets to count as a Hindu, and how that's being defined as an ethno-racial category on the one hand, and also as a religious category on the other.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So I was really fascinated at that point because just to put it in context with the greater Caribbean and what's happening in Trinidad, that process seems to be happening at the same time as the end of indenture and rising labor movements, not just in Trinidad, but also all over the Caribbean. And understandably, you don't dwell on that too much because you have a lot to cover in the book. But I was wondering if, is there some kind of a connection there, or do you see a relationship between those two processes?
With the end of indenture? Yeah, I mean, I think...
Yeah.
Yeah, so indenture ends in 1917. I think probably the you know, by that point, I think a lot of laborers had left plantations and had gone to create villages. I think the kind of rise of kind of labor unrest in the 1930s probably had an impact on kind of how Hindus were beginning to organize themselves. There were kind of fractures locally in Trinidad in terms of there's the Trinidad Working Man's, they had this Working Man's Association, this like a labor party, And so there were fights, kind of internal fights there. And this kind of question about the degree to which, the degree to which West Indian culture was a kind of something that could be marshaled as part of the creation of a national identity in Trinidad. And so there's a kind of a question of whether or to the degree to which Indo-Trinidadian culture could be West Indian culture. And part of that then becomes the legislature, for instance, there are arguments about, and we can see the way that people bring in Hinduism and how it's being defined to kind of adjudicate the questions of the day. So one of the things I look at is the debates about divorce. And there are these kind of young Trinidadian nationalists who are pro divorce and see the opposition to allowing divorce in Trinidad as being kind of anti-national and kind of backwards and kind of an old thing. In some ways they kind of turn to Hinduism and say, well, Hinduism allows divorce and this is potentially a kind of radical possibility there. But then at the same time, there are other people who are saying, no, Hinduism does not allow divorce. So Hinduism gets drawn into these kind of arguments about kind of how West Indian culture is being defined in significant ways.
And one of the ways that you talk about it that was really fascinating to me was as an embodied experience, right? So you have a chapter where you talk about exercise and sport and the military and drilling. There's this fascinating character, Ranjit Kumar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was hoping that you could talk about him. He's such an interesting figure and sort of tell us about his aims and his ideals and his trajectory in life, which was pretty circuitous.
Sure. Yeah. So Ranjit Kumar is a really fascinating figure. He was born in India, ends up going to school in England and getting educated there as a child and then a young adult. And then, goes through the kind of colonial, gets kind of certified and gets a place in the colonial bureaucracy back in India and goes back to India. But then kind of in his own accounts, he has a kind of collection of essays that are kind of autobiographical that says that he encounters corruption in the colonial bureaucracy. He's in the police force, and leaves that and actually ends up and is never himself. He doesn't go as an indentured laborer, is not somebody who's descended from indentured laborers, but ends up going to the Caribbean actually as a distributor of films and actually brings the first talkie. Indian talkie to Hindi language film to the Caribbean called Bala Joban, and then subsequently invests in other of these films and begins to go on tour with them, and ends up then settling down in Trinidad, goes on tour with the films I think in 1935, and by the late 1930s. When you have the kind of this heated battle between, as I mentioned, these two Hindu organizations, the Sanatan Tharam Association, the Sanatan Tharam Board of Control, the Sanatan Tharam Board of Control is kind of winning out at this point, and they have managed to get a missionary to come from India. This guy Purushottam Sharma, who is a kind of quote unquote orthodox Hindu missionary. Who is very successful in kind of galvanizing Hindus and particularly elite Hindus to the side of the Sanatan Tharam Board of Control. And when he finally leaves, Ranjit Kumar positions himself as kind of his heir and ends up starting this organization called the Trinidad Mahasabha, which is basically meant to be a kind of encompassing all Hindu organizations. So any particular Hindu organization in Trinidad would all kind of be a member of this organization. Ranjit Kumar in founding this organization is basically affiliates himself with all India Hindu Mahasabha in Trinidad, in India. And part of the Mahasabha's work in India is this kind of they have this project of masculinization. So there's the kind of common narrative, which has continues to influence politics in India, is this idea that Muslims were kind of strong and they were one of the kind of quote unquote martial races that the British government identifies, and that Hindus were seen as being kind of weak. And so the role of the Mahasabha in India was to kind of build up tough Hindu men. And so you have, for instance, groups like the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh in India, had these local organizations where particularly young men would go and they'd train with weapons, and they do kind of calisthenics and they'd march around. And Ranjit Kumar kind of picks up on this kind of physical culture movement in India and brings it to Trinidad and starts his own kind of, you have little kids then in beginning in the 1940s, early 1940s, they're kind of marching around in lockstep, and they have wrestling becomes important. They have cricket teams, the idea is that, or at least the kind of Trinidad Mahasabha ideology is that being in the West Indies and in Trinidad has led to a kind of deculturation of Indians and particularly Hindus. And so if you could build up particularly Hindu men, they could kind of have confidence in themselves. And then they're also the Mahasabha in Trinidad is also doing Hindi language training. People are beginning to lose Hindi as their first language, and then getting people to practice Hinduism. And this kind of all around kind of spiritual and physical development of Hindu men would then allow for the kind of fortification of a global Hinduism. And so in particular, the Trinidad Mahasabha situates itself as an international organization, right? And that's kind of where this idea of the world religion comes into it. I was interested in the ways in which the concept of a world religion wasn't performatively enacted kind of quote unquote locally by particular organizations in place. And so, that these members of this organization are imagining themselves as doing something similar to, Hindus in India or Hindus in South Africa or Hindus in Fiji, and kind of, by marching in lockstep and talking about these Hindus in other parts of the world, kind of performatively creating this world religion right there in Trinidad.
Yeah, I liked the extension of Benedict Anderson there, right? And when you suggested that, sure, we can, think about people thinking, creating communities by reading newspapers, but what about this idea of marching or these kind of physical actions? I thought, yeah, that seems right.
That physical that rituals themselves are kind of form of quote unquote imagining. That imagining is a practice. And it's not just sitting and reading newspapers, although certainly that's not, what Anderson says.
Right, no. not to discount Anderson.
No. His work was really formative in my thinking about how Hindu nationalism was being done in Trinidad.
Okay, so by the same token, it does sound like a very kind of masculinist set of practices, and I was wondering if there was a explicitly gendered dimension, or were women a kind of afterthought, or were they expected to participate? How does that figure in?
Yeah, so particularly the evidence that I'm using for the chapter on the Mahasabha is the newspaper articles and Ranjit Kumar's own writings, and then also that the Mahasabha had a newspaper. And I mean, women kind of don't come up a lot in a lot of the material. And I kind of had to kind of read against the grain and try and, wanted to see how kind of femininity was being constructed in this case. And so one of the things I do is look, there was a short story that was published in the bulletin of the Trinidad Mahasabha that talks about this woman, it's a story about a young woman her name is Mary, and she kind of falls in love with a young man who's a member of the Mahasabha, whose name is Krishna, and he, is kind of an ideal man in the Mahasabha. He does calisthenics and marches around, and he then, when they fall in love, he begins to teach her Hindi and begins to kind of bring her into the Mahasabha. And she's a nurse as a character. Her character is a nurse, and then also he gets into a fight. There's a man who's a Dogla, quote unquote Dogla, somebody who's both mixed, like Indian and African descent, and he attacks the woman Mary. And so Krishna comes in and you know, defends her honor, and he gets injured, and then she nurses him back to health. So it seems like women, for the most part, at least in Mahasabha ideology, are there to be kind of be protected, the same way that the land of India is meant to be protected by these by members of the Mahasabha who are kind of becoming martial, tough guys, but also are there to nurture, put band-aids on wounds, but also to kind of raise children, to teach children what they are learning from their husbands, seems to be the kind of model that was in place, at least for this organization.
So you close the book. I was really struck by a phrase that you used. You talk about the notion of haunting, mm-hmm. and you suggest that the second half of the book is haunted by the first, which I kind of understood as sort of suggesting that the establishment of world religion was haunted by its non-existence and the heterogeneity of practices and of rituals and relationships in the first. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if that's right. And I'm wondering if you could talk more about that, this notion of haunting.
Sure. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that sounds about right. Yeah, I mean, so the postscript, I call it, I talk about this example of Siprasad Naipaul, who was the father of V.S. Naipaul, the Nobel laureate. I found this set of kind of events around this Kali sacrifice, which I couldn't figure out where to put it in the book, but I had to felt like I had to do something with it. I felt like it kind of did a good job of kind of tying off the book. So Siprasad Naipaul was a member of the Arya Samaj, which is this, Arya Samaj is this reformist movement. Siprasad Naipaul refers to it as modern Hinduism. They're monotheistic. They don't worship idols. They're against animal sacrifice. And he has this kind of, he's a reporter, and he publishes this kind of flippant article where he says that that Kali devotion is, and particularly sacrifice to the goddess Kali, is kind of superstition. He calls it juju. And he gets then threatening letters from Kali devotees saying that Kali will kill him if he doesn't make a goat sacrifice. And at first he kind of jokes about it, but Kali doesn't leave him alone. And eventually he ends up actually making the sacrifice. And he makes light of it in a whole series of articles. But actually V.S. Naipaul in his memoirs writes that actually his father was really kind of was haunted by this. And he says it actually led to an emotional breakdown that he had, at least in part. And so Kali devotion itself, in some ways, gets marginalized in as Hinduism is being created as a quote-unquote world religion in Trinidad. And today, in some ways, is kind of a separate thing. Kali puja is a kind of almost a separate religion from Hinduism in Trinidad today. But even though, kind of middle-class Hindus are trying to marginalize Kali and everything that she represents, she doesn't go away, and she continues to kind of bug them. And I think you see that the ways that although Hindus and particularly middle-class Hindus are trying to create a respectable world religion called Hinduism, and in doing so, they're trying to kind of kick out the Christians and the Muslims who are participating in what are being defined as exclusively Hindu rituals. And in some ways, they're trying to kind of say that Hinduism is an Indian religion, and so that they're kind of narrowing the possibilities of Afro Trinidadians participating in what were being defined as Hindu rituals. Those attempts to try and standardize and rationalize Hinduism and to quote unquote purify it were never entirely successful, and are still not today. And so, I mean, that was, that very often these reformists and the, these middle-class Orthodox organizations are trying to sort of say that the kind of mixed and heterogeneous rituals and, Hindus and Muslims and Christians and Indians and Africans all coming together is a thing of the past, right? And we know proper Hinduism today, but at the same time, people continue to come together to mix, to cross reified racial and religious lines, and so as you said, the kind of first half of the book, which explores that heterogeneity of religion before Hinduism, really does haunt and today continues to haunt the category of Hindu, and I think does kind of bring the idea of Hinduism and also world religions more generally into question.
So it's a good place to ask you about, or just sort of ask you my final question, which is, what does this mean for Trinidad today? How is or is the Trinidadian present haunted by the kinds of processes that you describe in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think you still see these kind of arguments about whether or not various kinds of practices are Hinduism or are religion or not. I mean, I think Kali Puja is a particularly good example. For a long time, and Keith McNeil has done really interesting work on the history of Kali Puja. From the beginning of the 1970s or so after the end of the period that I look at, from around the period where my book ends, Kali devotion begins to decline in the 1950s or so. And it declines, but then it kind of resurges in the 1970s. And you have then coming together in the kind of ritual complex of Kali Puja, a whole set of different rituals that for a long time were seen as being problematic, but particularly by people who were engaging this kind of respectability politics, Hindu respectability politics. But even that then begins to be reformed. And so animal sacrifice was performed as part of Kali Puja, but now that is being kind of marginalized. So the kinds of arguments that I'm analyzing and debates and problematics that I'm analyzing in the book continue to be a set of issues. And kind of the politics of religion making go on in Trinidad today. You see something on the other side of that. You know, we were talking about Jose and Muharram before. With the arrival, I think beginning in the 1980s, of a kind of transnational Islam that's particularly influenced by Salafi Islam from Saudi Arabia, a number of Muslims begin to stop participating in Muharram or Jose because it's non-Islamic. They say. Some of my interlocutors and I spent time at a mosque, you know, doing interviews and kind of casually hanging out with an imam. And he told me growing up, he would regularly participate in Jose. But once he began to get kind of Islamic education from kind of reading materials that were influenced by the kind of Islam that's being backed by places like Saudi Arabia, he began to stop participating in it because it was. He said there's something sacred there, right? He knows that stuff is going on when they build the Tajas and when they're kind of invoking the imams. But he says he's not going to do it because it's not really Islam. I think there are ways in which the kinds of trends I'm tracing in the book continue on, but at the same time, you know, people are still doing Jose, although it's not as popular as it used to be. And you have Hindus and Muslims and people of Indian and African descent coming together to commemorate the martyrdom of the imams.
So I've taken up a lot of your time. I just, before I go, was wondering if you're working on a new project.
Sure, yeah. So I'm halfway through working on another book project that looks at I look at a series of case studies of people of Afro-Caribbean descent, but also Euro-American and Indian descent too, who are in different kinds of ways claiming the category Hindu, kind of identifying as Hindu for different kinds of ethno-racial and religious projects. And I'm looking at people who are kind of within the kind of larger circum-Caribbean, so people who are traveling around to different Caribbean islands, but also going to the US and also to the UK and India and West Africa as well. And so I'm particularly interested in looking at the ways and using the category Hindu to think about the ways in which the categories race and religion are really intertwined with one another and are being co-defined And actually, so part of the project I was published in the Journal of Comparative Studies in Society and History in 2016. And so kind of picking up on that and looking at, people, one of the people I look at is someone we mentioned, Lauren W. DeLawrence, who's this guy who's selling these magic books, who is also summoning Hindu spirits that give him instruction in Hindu magic. So hopefully hopefully that will be coming out in the next couple of years, but I don't know, who knows?
Well, that sounds really fascinating. I think it's going to open up a whole bunch of conversations like this book will as well. So thank you so much for talking to me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening, and see you next time when I'll be chatting with Professor Jorge Giovannetti about his new book.